Aquí se va a hacer.
Bueno, no, porque después hablaron porque
se va a hacer las flores aquí atrás. Lo escuchan en inglés.
So maybe you've got to move your simultaneous back there.
All right.
What are you on? So it's August 9th, 2018 in New Rajamundala, Spain, and all the advertisements for this course are wrong, okay? The sign on the door is wrong. The paper about the class is wrong. It's all wrong. So if you came here for that, sorry. But I think you'll find this more exciting. So I've been working for more than a year with a devotee named Rukmini, not the Prabhupada disciple Rukmini. She's her name is also Dr. Ruchira Datta. She has a PhD in mathematics. So she and I have been working over a year on a book about how to have a career, how to have a life that will both satisfy you materially and spiritually. And what are you translating into? But why doesn't she just go and get that Spanish?
Spanish not very well set.
So why don't you just go there, and you'll have no need to have two Spanish translations going on simultaneously. So when I heard that the topic of this conference was how to get situated in a career, I said, why don't we change, because I'm already doing work on that, and we can present...
So I cannot hear you.
We can present... you need a bit more volume. Okay, is that a little better? That's a little better, but not good enough. All right, let's make it good enough. Or let's make it really good. Is that better?
Yes.
All right. Excellent. If I speak too fast, or if I say anything you don't understand, will you please raise your hand and ask? Yes?
Yes.
Yes, everybody?
Yes.
That's my deal. Okay? If you think I've said something really crazy, you don't understand what I've said, just ask, or if I'm going too fast. So, Jenamata Hari Prabhu and I were discussing that because a lot of the people coming to this conference are having to recover from their journey this morning, that we're going to reverse the order in which I'm going to teach this, which is going to make it a little peculiar. But it means that the most exciting part will be this afternoon, this evening, whatever time. We haven't decided the time, right?
Not yet.
We're still working on that. So this afternoon, we're going to discuss about matching your nature to your work. We're going to discuss this, which I think is probably of the most interest to everybody. So, how to discover what is your nature, what are you good at, and how can you match that to the way you maintain yourself. So that will be this afternoon. And this morning, we're going to look at other principles. Now, we're not sure what we're calling our book. We're probably going to call it The Natural Art of Work. We're not going to use the word varna in the book. But this is about varna dharma. How
the
to
art of what?
The natural art of work. But for those of us who know the Sanskrit terminology, that would be varna dharma. But we're not going to use the word varna in the book. So many, many times, when people talk about varna, all they talk about are Brahmin, Kshatriya, Vaishya, Shudra. So we're not going to use those words at all. Okay? Just forget about those words. And we're going to talk about the principles of how to work nicely. So I'm sure many of you are thinking, all right, I really like Krishna consciousness, I like kirtans, you know, it's got a cool spiritual philosophy. I'd love, after I die, to go playing in the pasture with Krishna and Balaram and the gopis and the cows and the peacocks. That sounds like really, really cool. I mean, and Krishna is so interesting, and all the philosophy about reincarnation, Wonderful. But how do I live practically? I think for a lot of us, we think, you know, my Krishna consciousness is in one place and my life is in another place. Sometimes we may feel like we have to be two different people. You know, I can act one way at the temple with the devotees, but if I'm going outside at work or at school, or I have to be a different person. And I don't know how to integrate those. We also may feel that we don't really know how Krishna consciousness can help us be happy living a normal life. I think it's very unfortunate that many times we think that in order to have a full life of Krishna consciousness, I have to live in some rural community only with devotees, where I have a very limited range of career choices, at least at this point in ISKCON's history. Maybe 200 years from now, ISKCON communities will offer a full range of careers, and you could be, you know, a civil engineer and a court reporter and a fashion designer and live as part of an ISKCON project. But right now, in 2018, that is not available. And you may think that unless I live in some kind of ISKCON project, and it's got to be in the country, I've got to have cows, unless I do that, I can't really be Krishna conscious. And if you're drawn to other things in life, you may think, well, that means I have to give up part or all of my Krishna consciousness. So I am here to give you the good news that that is not a choice at all. Prabhupada said, Krishna is not narrow or stereotyped. One devotee recently at Nuvrajdam was telling me that his Guru Maharaj said to him, Krishna has unlimited desires. Just try to hook up with at least one of them. Now, I'm also here to say that our ideal is not only to create our own devotional communities, but our idea is to spiritualize the world. It's not that we want the whole world to go on in a materialistic, exploitive way, and we're in our little protected communities, you know, safe from all of the effects of the Kali Yuga. We want to change the world. Yes, is that true?
Yes.
We have a prediction that Mahaprabhu's Sankirtan movement is going to flood the world. My personal conviction is that especially many of you who were born and raised with some idea of Krishna consciousness have come here for that purpose. We would like the world to be such, I think we would like the world to be such, that the presidents and prime ministers of the world were God-conscious people. Wouldn't that be nice? Suppose the head of Monsanto and Walmart and Amazon were all God-conscious people. Would that be nice?
Yeah.
And suppose the leaders in sports and film and music and theater were God-conscious spiritual people. Think about any career, anything going on in the world. If we could even have 80-90% of those people who were spiritually minded, then basically it wouldn't even be Kali Yuga. That's what we want. In order to do that, people trained in ISKCON and by ISKCON have to go into the world and be the doctors and the engineers and the artists and the farmers and the business people and the prime ministers and the judges and the legislatures, and the soldiers, and the artisans, and everything. And if we can't figure out how people can do that in Krishna consciousness, we will never be more than a very small, closed institution that can only meet the needs of a small handful of people. Krishna consciousness would then become simply another religious faith. Something that you do for a few minutes or a few hours a day, and then you have your regular work. I think that would be very sad. When I came to the Hare Krishna movement, I did not intend to take up another religious faith. That was not my intention. My intention was to spiritualize my life and to have a revolution in the world. So what we're going to look at this morning is going to be, first of all, the world. We're going to start, in our book, we start from the individual and go to the society. I'm going to reverse that. Start from the society and go to the individual. So first we're going to talk about how an ideal society would function. Then we're going to talk about how individually we can employ 8 principles of Varna Dharma in our lives. 8, yes?
If the devotees who are in the back, move forwards, I won't disturb them so much because I am talking.
Well, there's hardly any room to move forward. Okay, a little bit. If everybody could move forward just like half a meter. All right.
If I disturb, please forward.
So one of the purposes of ISKCON is to bring the members closer to each other. So first we're going to talk about on a societal level how an ideal society would work together. Then we're going to talk about this morning 8 principles of Varna Dharma. Rukmini and I had a very sad experience. When we were first starting to work on this book, we were at a particular place, which I shall not name, listening to a particular devotee, whom I also shall not name, but it's a devotee who had studied about Varnashram for 20-25 years and was giving a class about Varnashram, and during the class he said, there are principles of Varnashram that are applicable in all times, places, and circumstances. So at the end of the class, I said, would you be willing to list the principles of Varnashram, just bullet points? And after kind of wandering for about 10 minutes, the only response from this person was, women should be good wives, and we should have cows. Are those principles of Varnashram?
No.
No, thank you. So you're not going to get that kind of a class today, okay? Don't worry. So in order to talk about societal and individual principles, we have to introduce something about the 4 fields of work. The 4 fields of work. So the 4 fields of work are the field of artistry, the field of resources, the field of government, and the field of ideas. Now, you may wonder why among all the hundreds and thousands or millions of ways that we could live, did Krishna categorize all these into these 4 fields? You're going to see the full answer to that this afternoon, when we look at what happens when individuals cross fields. Or maybe we'll look at that. Actually, no, we'll look at that this morning. Change my mind. So let's first define the 4 fields of work. So first is the field of artistry. People in the field of artistry provide all the beauty in society. Anything you see that is beautiful has come from someone in the field of artistry. Therefore, it is the field of artistry that provides rasa, or enjoyment. If there's no one in the field of artistry, there's no rasa. People in the field of artistry also provide all the functions. All of the functions of society. Without the field of artistry, society cannot work. Artistry is compared to the legs of the universal body and is directly under the control of Lord Vishnu. The field of artistry in the chakra system is comparable to the Mula chakra, which deals with function and physical needs, and the Swadhisthana chakra, which deals with beauty. The Swadhisthana chakra, it's hard to look at my paper and have the microphone right in my mouth, which deals with beauty, sweetness, and emotions. Then we have the field of resources. The field of resources deals with generating wealth. It's the only field of work that actually produces wealth. It produces wealth from the natural resources like the land, the sea, the air, the water in general, and from the animals. And basically, the field of resources is directing this flow of natural resources, also from plants. It's really hard to do. Is there some way I can move this microphone so that maybe like here, here? It's this part I want to move. So it's, it could be like this instead of straight at me. Is that possible? Okay, so these are the people in the field of resources. Can you hear me? Is it good? Mahalakshmi, can you hear me? All right, and you can also hear me. Excellent. So these are the people who generate wealth from the natural resources and spread them out to society. Right? These people are compared to the stomach of society. They're giving nourishment to everything, and they're working with the chakra, the Manipur chakra of vitality. Then there's a field of government. So the government is responsible for everyone in their domain. Whereas the people in the field of resources, they're only responsible for a particular area. The government is responsible for everyone. So they create and maintain rules. They protect from internal and external threats. And this can be not just technical government, but some non-governmental organizations also that do the work of government. Or things even like NATO or Interpol or things, the UN, those kind of structures would also be in this field. On a small...
What is in this field? I lost it.
Okay, so in the field, how far back do you want me to go?
What is in this field?
Okay, so in the field of government, you're responsible for everyone, not just a subset. You protect against internal and external threats. You produce laws, provide for peace and care. You provide necessities of life like water, electricity, schools, police force, roads. And people in this field may also work in related non-governmental agencies that provide similar services. And there may be also the field of government that's not part of a particular country like the UN or NATO or Interpol. So these people represent the arms of the universal body, and in the chakras are anahata, or the heart, because it is in this field that they're providing care for everyone. On a small level, people in this field can be a landlord, for example. So if you own a building, you're collecting rent and you're providing services. That's like a very, very small government. Then there's the field of ideas. These are the people that provide wisdom, guidance, truth, and education to society. They may be involved in research, study, teaching, counseling. They may be priests, writers, journalists. They are the head of the universal body, and this is involved with the throat chakra, Vishuddha for speech, and the Ajna chakra for wisdom. Right, so we're going to be talking later on this afternoon about how we can choose what field that we should be in, and we're going to be looking this afternoon not just at the fields, but also at the six opulences and how to find our nature and what can trip us up. Okay. Going to now the eight principles of how to work nicely in the world. So the first principle, which we will not discuss this morning at all, is that we should match our nature, our tastes, our desires to our particular work. So that principle is what you're good at, what you love, the fullest expression of yourself should also be the way that you maintain yourself. Not that you maintain yourself in a way that you don't like and you get to do what you like and what you're good at only as a hobby. Or you don't get to do what you like and what you're good at all. So that's the first principle. I think that's a principle that most people in the world would say, yeah, I'd really like to do that. I wish I could do that. I don't know how to do that. I'm not even sure how to find out what I like and who I am. And I'm not sure how I can maintain myself doing what I like. So again, we're going to look at that this afternoon. How do I figure out who I am, what I like, what I'm good at, and how do I match that to a livelihood? The second principle of Varna Dharma is that our work should be honest. Our work should be honest. Now, what does that mean? It means that whatever we do, we should receive the real value of our work in exchange.
What?
Whatever we do, we should receive the real value of our work in exchange. So one time I helped a devotee friend. She was running a cosmetics business, and one of her workers had left. So she asked me to please help her work in this business. I didn't like working there because I didn't feel it was honest work. We were selling a bottle of lotion for like $15, and I knew that the actual value of the lotion was probably about 50 cents. So the reason we were selling it for $15 was that about 15 people were each getting a dollar or 75 cents from this lotion. And I just felt terrible selling people something where the value of the thing I was selling was not in accord with what they were paying. And of course, much of the work that's going on in the world today is dishonest work. I remember in India buying this embroidered sari, hand-embroidered, the whole sari, the whole 5-6 meters, was hand-embroidered, and I paid $10 for that sari. And if you're thinking about, okay, the shopkeeper had to get something, the people that work in the shop had to get something, then there was maybe some kind of rent that was being paid for the shop, electricity for the shop, the person who transported the sari to the shop, right, and then they had to pay for petrol and so many things. The person who did the embroidery, the person who dyed the cloth, the person who wove the cloth, who spun the cotton, who grew the cotton. All of those people had to be getting some money. So how much was I paying the person who did the embroidery? I think I thought about that because I've done some embroidery and I'm extremely slow. For me to embroider a whole sari would probably take me about 5 years. And I was thinking, even if the person, probably a woman, who did this embroidery, even if it only took her 1 day or 2 days, and she was getting paid maybe a dollar for 1 or 2 days worth of work. And it was really bothering me because even if I paid the shopkeeper $20, that wouldn't change anything as far as the woman who did the embroidery. So our work...
Sometimes the voice goes...
Can we make it a little higher?
Yes.
So whatever work we do should be honest work. Now, I know that's a difficult thing to do in the modern day and age because I may have to work for a company or a business that's not honest. But as far as possible, at least for myself, I should make sure that the exchanges are honest, that things are fair. And I believe that there is a movement in the world today towards fair work, isn't there?
Yes.
Yes, a lot of companies are now advertising that we compensate people fairly. By the way, this principle of working in the world also means that we as consumers should be willing to pay a fair price. I think many times we will go to pay a cheaper price even though we know that people are getting cheated. Now, honesty doesn't have to do just with fair exchange. It has to do with providing for people's real needs. Prabhupada uses the term unneeded needs. The modern term is more manufactured needs. Another thing when I worked for my friend's cosmetic company is our star product was a nail polisher. Not nail polish, not the liquid, but a polisher. So it was kind of like very fine sandpaper. And you took this and you rubbed it over your nails, and I never knew until I did this job that our nails have little ridges on them. If you try feeling it right now, you'll notice your nails have little ridges. They're not smooth. So when you smooth out your nails, they become reflective and they become shiny. So we would accost people in the aisle of the mall, actually go up to them. I felt like I was doing book distribution, but I wasn't doing books. We would walk up to people and we would basically polish their nail for them. Excuse me, can I polish your nail? And we would polish one nail with this little thing. And then they'd look at it and they'd go, wow. And then we would bring them over to our kiosk and we would sell them this completely useless and stupid thing that nobody needed. Nobody woke up in the morning and said, I have little ridges in my nails. Oh no. Oh, my life is so unhappy. I have to take the ridges. Nobody woke up that morning saying they needed a $15 nail ridge remover. But we convinced people that they needed it. Right? So that was dishonest. You manufacture a need, people are getting along just fine without it, there's no problem, everybody's happy, and you convince them that they need something that doesn't add to the quality of their life in any way, shape, or form. So whatever we are doing should be to meet people's real needs. That doesn't mean just food and clothing. People also have psychological needs and social needs and intellectual needs. Psychologists list a whole group of people's needs. But we should be really doing something that people need. And we should not be doing any harm. We should not be doing any harm. This, again, is a very difficult thing to do in modern society. Practically everything in society is harming somebody. It's harming, you know, insects, or it's harming animals, or it's harming the earth, or it's harming somebody in China or India who's working without, you know, medical insurance in an unsafe environment. It's extremely difficult to work without harming anybody. But as far as possible, our work should not be doing any harm. So this is the second principle. Our work should be honest. And in the category of honest, there's three subcategories. It should be fair and equitable. We shouldn't be cheating anybody. We should be providing for genuine needs, not manufactured needs. And we should not be harming anybody. Now, I will tell you that while I worked for my friends, a devotee friend, cosmetic company, I was not satisfied. Now, one reason I was not satisfied is that that work was completely contrary to my nature. I am not at all a salesperson. But the main reason it was dissatisfying me was it wasn't honest work. If it had been honest work, even though it was contrary to my nature, I wouldn't have been so disturbed. But even though I made a little money from it, and at that time in my life, I had absolutely no money. I was completely impoverished. The money I made from that job was the only money that I had. So even though I made a little bit of money from it, the money itself didn't satisfy me. So my own doctoral research was in the area of job satisfaction. That was what I did my PhD thesis on. And the evidence is out there, money is not a source of job satisfaction. It's very clear. Now, if you can't even eat, if you don't even have a house, then you need some money to be satisfied. But over having the basic necessities of life, money does not give people satisfaction. There's no research to the contrary. Sometimes people are happy with money if the money symbolizes something else. If the money symbolizes some recognition for a job well done, or an increase in status or something like that. But the money in and of itself is not that. So if we get paid a lot, but our work is not fair, it doesn't provide real needs, and it harms others, we won't be happy with what we're doing. Now, I think, again, people in the world sort of kind of know this, but I don't believe that most people understand how important it is. I really don't think that most people understand how important it is. And this principle of Varna Dharma, this principle of how to work in the world, is something that we Hare Krishna people can bring from our ancient wisdom of the Bhagavatam and the Bhagavad Gita to the people of the world. Not only in your life, but something that we can teach others. Okay, third principle. This principle is so amazing. We could easily speak on this for many hours. In fact, my co-author Rukmini and myself have each given a 1.5-hour class just on this principle. And that is that our work should have real value. You say, well, wait a minute, Urmila. I thought you just said honest work meets people's needs. Isn't that value?
I lost it because someone had to...
You might say, Urmila, honest work is meeting people's needs. Isn't that a value? You may be shocked to find out that the answer is no. That's just honest work. Now, so far, the first two principles of Varna Dharma are such that even materialistic people might come up with themselves. That if you want a satisfying life, you should work according to your nature, your work should be honest in terms of fair, meeting people's needs and not being harmful. Right? That's not too hard to figure out. But this one can only be understood spiritually. So we understand there's something called the law of karma, yeah? The law of karma means whatever anybody's getting, they have already paid for. If someone's getting something good, they did something good. If they're getting something bad, they did something bad. They paid for it. And I am not capable of giving somebody something that they haven't paid for. I can't do it. If I was capable of giving you something good that you didn't deserve, I would also be capable of giving you something bad that you didn't deserve. Would that be fair? No, it wouldn't be fair. Therefore, I have no capacity at all, zero, to give you anything good or bad that you don't deserve. All I can do is be the delivery person. Is everybody clear on that? So can I add value to your life? On the material level, is it possible for me to improve your life or add value to your life beyond what you would get anyway? Is that possible?
No.
No.
Yes? No?
No.
Okay.
No.
Wow. Many studies have shown that in order for work to be satisfying, it has to have meaning. It has to have purpose. We have to feel that we're actually adding something of value, but we just discovered that on the material plane, we can't do it. Also, you know that according to science, matter is neither created nor destroyed. Everybody knows this? You can change matter into energy or energy into matter, but the total substance remains static. Yes, everybody knows this? It's not increasing. We're going to look at this later in view of sustainability. Again, this is a reason why I can't add value. This is another reason why I can't add value. I can't change the total amount of energy on the material level. It is static. Anywhere it goes up, in a corresponding way, it's got to go down. Is that clear to everybody? Like in the law of karma. To get good karma, you have to do some austerity. And it's true collectively. Anyway, things go up in one area, they go down in another. You cannot make an absolute increase of value either individually or collectively. Well, now that everybody is thoroughly depressed and sad, we Hare Krishnas and other religions too. It's not that we're the only one. We have the secret as to how you can actually do something that has real value, that creates an absolute increase without any corresponding decrease, and where each of us can be the actual agent of that increase. Like Krishna says, we're a fool. Ahankar avimudhat makartaham iti manyate. We're a fool if we think we're the doer materially. Yes? Materially, what am I doing? Everything is going to stay in balance, and everyone's going to get what they're going to get. But spiritually, Krishna is always increasing. Spiritual energy is not static. It is dynamic.
I need to see you, and this devotee is covering. If he could sit a bit on the right. If I don't see you, it's harder for me to understand.
Okay. Krishna is not static. He's dynamic. He's always increasing. Materially, material energy is static. Just like we have a limited resources on this planet. Yes? But Krishna is always increasing, and there's no corresponding decrease. Krishna says in the Bhagavad Gita, in this endeavor, there is no... anybody else? Loss or diminution. In spirituality, there's no loss. Materially, there's always a loss. Anything we gain is because we agreed voluntarily to do some loss. Does everybody understand that? I have to pay for all my good karma. Every bit of good karma, I had to pay for it. There was some loss somewhere. Yes? I diminished something in order to get something.
Can you give an example?
Can I give an example? Let's say that I give in charity, which helps me become rich. So I give up some money to get money. I work hard in order to get a promotion. I do some austerity in order to get something. Spiritually, that is not the case. The only austerity you have to give up to get bhakti is to give up pain and suffering. That's all. So that's not a loss, right? Yes?
If you give something in charity, don't you usually get more back?
Don't you usually get more back than you give?
That you gave in the first place.
Depends. That's a very good question. We're going to do charity next, so can I go to that there?
Yes.
Okay. Thank you. So spiritually, let's say I give somebody direct association with Krishna. I have then given that person something that has an absolute increase without a corresponding decrease. Does everybody understand that?
Yes.
If I connect somebody with the unlimited, that's always increasing, they can experience an absolute increase without a corresponding decrease. And I can be the agent of that without them deserving it. That's what mercy means. Mercy means something that someone doesn't deserve. And Vishnu Chakravarti says, the Lord's mercy follows the mercy of the devotee. That means I, as a soul, can use my free will and my agency to decide myself to give somebody else Krishna. I actually become the doer. I'm doing something. And I can offer them Krishna, which will give them an absolute increase. So the way for what I do in life to have value is if my work also connects people with the infinite and the ever-expanding source. And you say, oh no, doesn't that limit my work just to like distributing books and prasadam and going on Harinam? No. We can connect people with Krishna through any work at all. Do you know that we can connect people with Krishna just by our good wishes? Rupa Goswami, Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu. If I just want someone to be connected with Krishna, if I do my work in such a way, whatever my work is, unless it's something dishonest or harmful, it's got to be honest work. If I do my work in such a way that people even think, oh, that's really a special person. The first time I met Srila Prabhupada, my father asked Prabhupada, I'm coming to this temple just to see my daughter and son-in-law. I'm not interested in Krishna. Is that okay? Prabhupada said, yes. So they are loving Krishna and you are loving them. So two things equal to the same thing are equal to each other. If we are full of Krishna consciousness, even if other people don't know that, if somehow or other they like us, they will get in touch with the infinite and we will be a channel of mercy for them to experience an absolute increase. Just imagine that. You just have to be a nice person so people will like you. And you have to be connected with Krishna. And that way, any work you do, even if apparently very ordinary, will create real value. Okay, fourth principle is charity, giving in charity. So you brought up the question that don't we get individually an absolute increase when I give in charity because I get back more than what I gave? But if you don't use that charity nicely, then it will again be taken away. So you have to make sure, everything goes into balance. And this is why we see some people are very charitable in one life, they're very rich in the next life. In that life, they use it for themselves, and the next life, they're poor. So everything will go back into balance. When we get more than what we give in charity, that more is meant for distribution. So we have to voluntarily take it and give it away in charity yet again. And you see, in fact, that many people who are very rich are extremely charitable. But sometimes this charitable, Bill Gates is a very good example of this, that sometimes this charitable disposition will continue over many, 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 many lifetimes. We give in charity, from that we become wealthy, from that we give charity, from that we become wealthy. As far as how much money we have in this life, and money is not the only kind of wealth, we'll be discussing that much more this afternoon, what are the six kinds, ways to be rich. But whatever wealth we have given in charity in the past. And if we want to be wealthy in the future, we should give in charity at the present. Yes?
How we say that we get more than we give? I don't.
There's a karmic law that if you give in charity, that you will get a corresponding amount in your next life. If you give in charity to a worthy person, you will get more. So if you give in charity to a worthy person, you'll get at least four times back. If you give in charity to a brahmana, you get 1,000 times back. A Prabhupada said if you give in charity to a pure devotee, you can get even unlimited back. I had a very funny example of this in New Zealand. So Jayapataka Swami was visiting. This was before he had the stroke. And he had two assistants with him. And, you know, as I travel in the world, I'm very aware that some temples will pay for your airfare and some won't. It's just how it is. So New Zealand, at least at that time, they would never pay your airfare. And of course, to go to New Zealand, it's always a rather big, it's not a small ticket. You know, New Zealand's in the middle of nowhere. So Jayapataka Swami had traveled with two assistants, and he had said on the Vyasasan, he said, which I thought was interesting, he said, you know, the temple doesn't pay for the airfare of traveling preachers, so if anybody wants to contribute to the airfare of myself and my assistants, we would be grateful. So myself being a traveling preacher and knowing what that means to go someplace where the place doesn't pay your airfare, so I gave him $50. I said, this is for your airfare. And the next day, one devotee came up to me and gave me $500. And I thought, oh, that's how it works. I mean, that wasn't my intention. I didn't give to him with that intention, but I thought it was very funny. So yes, we do get an increase. Why? I mean, just like if you have several children, if you give a plate of cookies to one child and they eat it all themselves, you're not going to give them the plate of cookies next time. If you give them a plate of cookies and they give it to their brothers and sisters, right? Or if they give it also to their friends. So Krishna sees what he gives us. Do we share? If we share, he gives us more. If we're discriminating about who we share with, if we share with worthy people, he gives us even more. So the more that we share, the more that he gives. The less that we share, the less that he gives. And generally speaking, if we're struggling financially, it means that we didn't give last time around.
If we discriminate, then he will give us more.
Absolutely. In other words, if let's say that I just got 1,000 euros and I went up in a helicopter and I just threw it all down on the street. I mean, think of it ourselves. Let's say you gave me 1,000 euros and I did that. Would you give me another 1,000 euros? But you, I'm talking about you.
Depend what is my value.
I'm asking you.
If you want to throw it, then
you don't care. I can throw it out of the helicopter. Okay. Suppose I took the 1,000 euros and I said, okay, I'm going to give it to the little Avanti. I'm going to give 100 to the little Avanti school. I'm going to give 100 to the deity worship. I'm going to give 100 to some poor sadhus in Vrindavan. I'm going to give 100 to this devotee who's sick. I was discriminating about how I gave it out. Would you be more likely to give me $1,000 next time?
Of course.
Yes.
Because
exactly.
It's for a good cause.
Exactly. So just like a devotee was telling me the other day, I give to charity where I trust the people, I trust how they're going to spend it. And Krishna is the same way. If Krishna gives us wealth and we use it all for ourselves, then in the future, he's only going to give us enough for ourselves. If I give in charity without discrimination, I just give to everybody, I'll get more because at least I'm generous. But if I'm discriminating and I give to people who really need it or people who are really going to use it, then he's going to give me even more. So the main principle of becoming wealthy is to give. I know it seems counterintuitive, but that's the way the universe works. That's the way Krishna has designed everything. And again, we're all like that too. I'm much more likely to give things to people if I see they use it nicely. And if I see that I give someone more than they need, how they share it. Right? It's just like I have a devotee friend who's a very successful businesswoman. She donated $500,000 to the TOVP. A very successful businesswoman. She runs 5 boutiques. And she was asking me at various times she likes to give donations, and she was asking me to give a list. She did this 2 or 3 times of various projects and devotees who I felt were worthy. So, I did that, and she chose from the list. And then her husband said to her, why don't you just give all the money to Urmila and let her distribute it? Because I run a nonprofit. She said, give it to her nonprofit, she'll distribute it for you. And that was so much fun, actually, to take my friend's money that she had earned and, okay, here we'll give it. This preacher, he needs a new altar. This cow protection program needs something. We got to distribute it very widely. And I really got a sense that whenever we're giving in charity, it's like that. It's Krishna's money. It's not my money. Even if I've earned it, it's Krishna's. And I get to share that happiness with so many people. So that is the principle. Now, in this principle of Varna Dharma, this is the 4th principle, at least, this is not a popular idea, at least you should share with your family. Which is why in traditional societies,
I didn't get, now we are entering the 4th, have you mentioned which is the 4th?
Charity.
Charity, okay. Yeah,
sure. So at least one should share with one's family. In modern society, single people work and keep all the money themselves. This concept is completely absent in traditional society. And this is very unpopular, what I'm about to say, so you can just erase this part if you don't like it. Bhaktivinoda said, I wanted to earn money, therefore I got a wife. So often the way we think is, I have a wife, or I have a husband, I have children, therefore I should earn money. But Bhaktivinoda said, I wanted to earn money, therefore I got a wife. The idea is, if I'm going to earn wealth, I have to have at least one other person that I'm sharing it with. To never have the concept that I am earning only for myself. To always think that whatever wealth I get, and we'll talk also again this afternoon about the six kinds of wealth. It's not only money. It's not only money. It's not only money. It's not only money. Wealth is not only money. Whatever kind of richness I have, I should share. And I should do this to please Krishna. On a materialistic level, I should do this because I'll be happier and I'll be wealthier. On a spiritual level, I do it to please Krishna. The fifth principle of Varna Dharma is sacrifice. Now, this word sacrifice is used in Sanskrit not to mean giving up something, but it really means engaging in some sort of religious ceremony. So I should remember that everything I'm getting is from the Supreme. I cannot create wealth out of nothing, no matter what wealth it is. I'm creating wealth out of some kind of raw materials that are supplied from God. And therefore, on a regular basis, I should give some kind of thanks, some kind of gratitude, some kind of connection. Whether it's every day chanting Hare Krishna, worshipping the deity, reading the Bhagavatam, having a kirtan, or whether it's reading the Bible and offering some prayers, offering a candle, whatever it is. We talk in the book about four ways of understanding the Supreme as the universal form, as Brahman, as Paramatma, and as Bhagavan. And we talk about four ways of connecting through Karma Yoga, Gyan Yoga, Dhyan Yoga, and Bhakti Yoga. In our Krishna Conscious novel, we also speak about these. So we're not presenting to the world that the natural art of work means you have to be a Hare Krishna Gaudiya Vaishnava. It doesn't mean you have to see God as Bhagavan. It doesn't mean you have to do Bhakti Yoga. You could see God as a universal body and do Karma Yoga. But some kind of regular connection with our source. Some kind of regular connection with our source. Otherwise, we're not even grateful. And also, we're not even honest. As Prabhupada said, we become a thief. If we're just taking from the world and using for ourselves. Okay, the sixth principle of Varna Dharma is cherishing the sources of our wealth. Taking care of the sources of our wealth. Which is very much, the sixth and seventh principle is very much related to the idea of sustainability. That whatever we're doing to work and be wealthy and be rich and be prosperous should be something that can be sustained. So the first thing, our first source of wealth is our own body, our own mind, to take care of our body and mind. And like in American football, the sport damages the body so much that most people who engage in the sport get brain damage.
Brain damage.
Yes, permanent brain damage. I was reading from one former football player, American football, who said, we American football players are like prostitutes who are ruining our body for the pleasure of others. And I thought, wow. So to cherish our sources of wealth means to take care of our physical health and our mind. That may mean not working too many hours or not working in an unhealthy environment. This is very related to working according to our nature. Cherishing the people we work with, our co-workers, the people who work under us, our supervisors, being nice to them, taking care of their needs, making sure that they're happy in their work, that they have what they need. Many times, even in ISKCON, we think in order to get the job done, it doesn't matter how I treat other people. That all we, this is service, Prabhu. Who cares if you don't sleep and don't eat and you're not happy? It's for Krishna. No. To cherish the sources of our wealth. And of course, taking care of the environment. Making sure that whatever we do is taking care of the earth. And we're going to look at the six kinds of wealth, which we'll discuss a lot more this afternoon. But how do we take care of them? So one source of wealth, we're going to use the Sanskrit name for these because they're complex ideas that really cannot be communicated with just a one-word translation. So let's say we have a wealth of virya, which is vitality and strength. So the way we protect that is by protecting our health and our vitality and our strength, as well as having a career that protects the health and vitality and strength of those who work with us or those who use our services or our products. If we are enjoying the wealth of Sri, which is beauty and splendor, then we want to make sure that we protect beauty in the environment, that we don't make the environment ugly, that we contribute to beauty. If we are enjoying Aishwarya, which is power and leadership and autonomy, then we want to make others feel smart. We want to empower others, not just enjoy our own autonomy and leadership. If we are enjoying the wealth of Yasha, which is rightly earned fame, then we also want to build communities and we want to be grateful. If we are enjoying the wealth of Jnana, of wisdom, of knowledge, of understanding, then we want to love clarity. We want to love understanding. We want to nurture truth in society. If we are enjoying the wealth of Vairagya, which is detachment and freedom, then we want to give everyone freedom and not repress others. In this way, we cherish the particular way in which we get wealth. Then the seventh principle is to cherish our field of work, to make sure our field of work is sustainable. So let's say we work in the field of artistry. This would mean that we make sure there are standards of quality and service in our particular field, that we don't produce shoddy products. This would mean not going to a factory-based model or an automated-based model, that we want to protect the beauty and the craft of our particular field. If we're in the field of resources, then we're particularly going to protect the animals and the air and the land and the water. You know, in the modern world, they try to make the animals fat as quickly as possible by giving them so many artificial chemicals, right? They're pouring chemicals into the earth and the water. In the field of government, we want to protect all people, not just people who voted for us or special interests, in fact, all living beings. And we protect our field in government by having long-term thinking, what's going to be best for the people we take care of, not just today, but in the long term. In the field of ideas, we protect the field by having independence, by making sure that we can't be compromised by others' special interests, by allowing for a diversity of views, for not limiting ourselves to one point of view, and also by looking at the long term. Then we have the eighth principle of Varna Dharma, and this is very nicely explained in the Bhagavad Gita, chapter 3, text 30. This is working without ego, without thinking, I am the doer. This is my work. I am proud of my work. As soon as we work with ego, then we are going to be affected by other people's opinions of us. We're going to be affected by the natural ups and downs in the world. You know, if something doesn't work out, we're devastated. If something works out, we're elated. We're not able to be equipoised and peaceful. But some people think that working without ego means I have no impetus to work. I am just lethargic. Okay, I have no ego, so I just don't care. So Krishna says in 3:30, and I really like the original translation, not the new edited translation, that one should work without ego or lethargy. So this has six subparts, three positive, three negative. By the way, I'm sure you've gotten so far that I'm just doing an overview, yeah? Yes, everybody's gotten that I'm not going into depth. This will be a whole book. And when the book is done, the plan is that Rukmini and I would give like an hour seminar or a 2-hour seminar in each part. Yes? So this is just an overview to give you some idea of what direction to go in and some appreciation that the Bhagavad Gita and the Bhagavatam give guidance by which the whole world could be transformed even in such a practical, everyday area as how we are living. So let's look at the six ways, three positive and three negative, to work without ego and without lethargy. So the three positive: dedicate our work to Krishna. So not just connect with the Supreme like once a day or once a week, but at every moment. This moment is for you. This moment is for you. This moment is for you. Prabhupada wrote a letter to Jayapataka Swami that surrender to Krishna means to think, whatever is meant to be, that I am doing. So I am always in the perfect place. Let me work with full attention to every detail, to do it expertly, to every detail, to be absorbed in my work, whatever it is, all other considerations be forgotten, and to work for Krishna's alone pleasure as my motive. So Krishna's watching me now. He's watching how I'm dealing with my craft, or how I'm dealing with this person, or how I'm dealing with these ideas. Would he smile? Would Krishna smile? Would he be happy? To let go of desires to enjoy prosperity independently from Krishna. The six kinds of wealth, which we'll be discussing more this afternoon, are all expansions of Radharani, the internal energy. When I try to enjoy them separately, I get expansions of Durga. When I enjoy them, as Prabhupada would say, through Krishna, then I actually enjoy them. The third positive thing is awareness of our spiritual self. To always be aware that I'm not a doctor, I'm not a farmer, I'm not an artist, I'm not a banker, I'm not a son, daughter, husband, wife, I'm not any of these things. I am pure spirit soul. The three negatives to let go of ego and lethargy is to let go of ownership. Krishna owns everything. Krishna owns everything, not me. I'm just working for his pleasure. Like when you work in a big company, right? You don't own the company. You work for the pleasure of the boss, and the boss pays you. So we work for Krishna's pleasure, and he takes care of us. Then to act in our own nature, not to imitate others' nature. And Krishna says not to have a lethargy born from fever. What do you mean? Jwara. Not to be feverish. So feverish we can think of if you're like overexcited in sort of a non-thinking way. You know, I gotta do this, I gotta do this, I gotta do this, I gotta do this. That's kind of feverish. And feverish can also mean you're sick with a fever, and so you just can't move. It's kind of, I can't do anything. So not to have either kind of fever, to be balanced. Okay, this is a very long class, and I want to go on now to systems, to society. But I thought before doing that, we need a 30-second break. So I want everyone to stand up, including me. One point of the positive. Okay, so the points of the positive are: dedicate your work to Krishna at every moment. Let go of desires to enjoy the various kinds of wealth independently. Enjoy them through... This is just a repeating, so it's fine. Enjoy the six kinds of wealth through Krishna and be aware of our spiritual self. Always identify as a soul rather than identifying with your labels. And the three negatives were: let go of false ownership, don't do someone else's nature, and don't have a lethargy born of fever. Don't be feverish. Did you have a question back there?
Same question, but I still didn't get it. The second one, which was that?
Okay, so...
The second positive.
Let go of desires to enjoy prosperity independent of Krishna. So it says that when Radharani pleases Krishna, the devotees are also nourished. So when I work to please Krishna, his pleasure energy also nourishes me. All the kinds of wealth are under the control of the internal energy. So if I want to enjoy them separately from Krishna, I'm getting Durga, and I will suffer. If I enjoy them through Krishna, then I will be happy. So basically, enjoy our prosperity through Krishna. That's the second positive. Okay? Are we ready to go on to systems?
Yes.
All right. Now, this section is probably of more interest to people who work with systems. But I still think that it's a good idea to get some kind of picture that if a majority of people worked according to the principles of the Gita and the Bhagavatam, how would society in general work? So here we're looking at four different items. So these are also principles of Varna Dharma, but these are four systemic principles. So we looked at eight individual principles, and now we're looking at four systemic principles. So the first one is competition is good. Prabhupada said competition brings life. There's even competition in Goloka Vrindavan. But the competition should be within a field and not between fields. We should not be having a competition between people in the fields of ideas and people in the field of artistry. Even in a field, one should be competing within a particular kind of work. What does competition do? Well, it keeps the quality of work high. Let's think about this in, say, sports. So by having sports competition, it pushes the people in that sport to aim for a higher and higher level of quality. Does that make sense? Yes? I saw this when we were in North Carolina. We were running a Gurukul there. And at one point, some devotees decided to start a competing community. There was a temple and a Gurukul, and they decided they wanted to start a competing community 10 minutes away with their own temple and their own school. So there was a huge objection. Everybody objected in the first community. And even in the second community, their first idea was they said, we really want another teacher other than you, and we want to bring that teacher into your school and you pay him.
I didn't get that.
They said, we don't want just you as the teacher. We want another teacher. We want to bring him into the school and you pay him. And we said, we don't have a big enough school to accommodate him, and we don't have the money to pay him. Start your own school. And hardly anybody thought that was a good idea, to have two temples and two schools. It was wonderful. It was the most wonderful experience I have had in ISKCON, absolutely, hands down, no discussion. Politics stopped. Criticism stopped. The community tripled in size within like 3 months. All of a sudden, people had a choice. They could go to this temple or that temple. They could send their kid to this school or that school. And we were really competing. I mean, both of the schools had boys and girls ages 5 to 18. It wasn't like one was a girls' school and one was a boys' school. We were teaching the same group of kids. And all of a sudden, if people were critical of me or my school, all I had to do was say, you know what? There's another school. You can go there. And the really critical people would go back and forth. They'd move their children every other month. But we used to charge $100 every time you re-enrolled your child. So pay us another $300. Okay. And it was just a beautiful thing. And it really pushed both the temples and both the schools to improve in their quality. It gave me some idea of what a whole Krishna conscious society would be like. You know, in Madrid, we don't want one temple. We want what? 50. Right? And some temples will focus more on Harinam, and some will focus more on Shastra, and some will focus more on Archana. Some will have a whole variety. Right? And people will gravitate to where they feel comfortable. And each temple will compete. I mean, I even saw that when devotees started sending their kids to non-devotee schools, the gurukuls all of a sudden had to be better. There's something about competition that pushes people to do better. And Prabhupada encouraged competition. I mean, really encouraged competition. When Prabhupada was here, the temples were competing mostly as to who could distribute the most books. That was our main competition. But it was fierce. between one temple and another, and one project or another. I mean, it was very intense. In the old New York temple on 55th Street. So maybe I'll tell you the whole story because it's really a funny story. So one day at Guru Puja, the kirtan didn't end for class. It kept going. And we had an 11-story building with a downstairs, so 12 floors. And the devotees went out of the temple room and they took the kirtan to the kitchen. They were banging on the pots. They took the kirtan through every floor of the building and we had no class that day. It was very spontaneous. So the temple president didn't like that because he was scheduled to give class that day. But anyway, it did happen again. It happens sometimes that somehow the kirtan went on and it went out of the temple room. So Tamal Krishna Maharaj was our GBC, and he said, why don't we schedule this for every Monday evening? So every Monday evening, and then we took little Radhakrishna on a palanquin, and we took them, the little deities on a palanquin, all over the temple. Well, as soon as the deities went all over the temple, spontaneously, the devotees, because they would pass by our rooms, it was a huge building. I mean, we had about 350 devotees living there. When the deities went past our room, somebody had the idea to have their door open and greet the deities as they came by their room and have like some incense and a flower. And then other people said, hey, I want to do that. They said, I want to do that too. And so pretty soon there was a competition and everybody had their door open. And guess what? We all cleaned our rooms, right? And nobody said this is going to be a Maha cleanup day. We just naturally did it. And pretty soon there was a competition between the rooms. Who could give the deities the nicer offering when they went by? And then I think it was, we had two floors for the brahmacharis, one for the brahmacharinis, one for grahastas without children, one for grahastas with children, one for general guests, one for VIP guests and Prabhupada. And then we had a floor for Back to Godhead, we had a floor for the theater, and we had offices, and then downstairs we had the restaurant, the bakery, and the kitchen. So I think it was one of the brahmachari floors that decided that one Monday, the whole floor was going to get together. So when the deities came to that floor, the brahmacharis were all there, I forget what they were doing, but something, chanting verses, or they did a drama or something. And then the devotees on the other floors said, oh, we're going to do something too. And so the next Monday, another floor did something. And by the third Monday, each floor, when the deities came to that floor, you know, we would decorate the floor, we'd get leaves and flowers from Central Park, or we would do a drama, or we'd recite the whole Brahma Samhita, or something, you know. And pretty soon, every floor was competing, and every room was competing, and then the temple authorities started giving prizes. And it was wonderful. I mean, it would just transform the whole temple, but it happened very spontaneously. The whole thing happened very spontaneously. But I saw that this competition, as Prabhupada says, it gives life. Of course...
How long went on?
What?
For how long time? For how long went on?
I don't know. I mean, we moved out of that temple. What year did we move? It was still going on when we left. Maybe it went on until the building was sold.
I mean, months or...
Oh, months. Definitely months. Maybe years. Definitely months. Perhaps years. I don't know. The building was sold, and that's a very sad... Sad story. I don't want to talk about it at all. I don't want to talk about that building being sold. Don't ask me to talk about that. Then I'll start crying and I won't be able to finish the class. Okay, so seriously, I mean really, I would really start crying. So competition is not about being a predator. It's not about pushing other people down. It's about fair play. It's about having compassion and respect for those we defeat. It's for, as far as possible, having win-win, competing with people who are equal, and remembering that we all have common ground. Not getting into a tribalism, you know, in my group versus your group, and we're better than you. Not that kind of competition. I remember when I was visiting one of my children. So they took their sons to play some sporting events. And I went, I really went like, oh, I don't really care about sport. I've never cared about sporting events. And I thought, oh, you know, I'm being dragged along by my family, okay. But it ended up being something that was very positive for me. They were playing baseball, and at the beginning of the baseball game, both the teams said, you know, we offer this game to God, which was really interesting. It wasn't devotees or any religious organization at all. You know, we offer this game to God, and for the glory of God, for the glory of our country, for the glory of our community, for the glory of our family, and, you know, with full respect for the other team, and everybody on one team shook hands with everybody on the other team, play a good game, play a good game. And they trained the young boys that when someone on the other team did something good, you cheered for them too. You appreciated, oh, someone on the other team did something good. And at the end of the game, again, everybody shook everybody's hand, everybody high-fived everybody, and everybody said, good game, good game. I was very moved. I was actually really moved by this. And I thought, they're teaching these children a principle. And this principle applies to the workplace as well. That we should compete within our field. We should definitely compete within our field, but it should be for the pleasure of the Lord, to increase the quality of what we're doing, both to keep the purity of the field and for the benefit of society and without envy. I mean, even the Brahmins used to compete, right? They used to have debates, right? There'd be Brahminical debates. Why do you think they had Brahminical debates? It was to keep the purity of truth and wisdom in the society and to make sure what you were offering to the public was actual wisdom. The Kshatriyas, they would compete, you know, in sporting events, but also war was for that purpose. And of course, businesses competing and the artisans competing. All right, then also cooperating. So cooperating as ideas that we're all part of the universal body. We're all part of the body of God. Each of us is like a cell in an organ of the universal body. We see the world as a family. Every career, every job should be to help one another, right? And to remember that we have things in common even with people in other fields. For example, both people in the field of ideas and the field of artistry value simplicity. Both people in the fields of resources and artistry deal with practical and tangible things. People in the field of government and resources are both dealing with practical leadership, expansion, and distribution of means and goods. People and ideas and resources tend to lack sentimentality and be interested in critical thinking, and people in artistry and government are both involved with serving people directly. So although we have different fields, we have something in common with people of other fields, and we have areas of overlap where we can cooperate with them. Right? And just as a general way, people in the field of ideas, they're advising and teaching everyone. Government is giving peace and licenses for everyone. Resources are giving food to everyone. Artistry is helping each field and allowing for each field to communicate to the other fields and providing, again, for the beauty of everyone. Then the third systemic principle is that checks and balances. Each field is meant to regulate the other fields. Checks, it's an American saying, checks and balances. Regulating, like in Vedic sacrifice, there's the main priest and there's the checker priest. How do you explain that in Spanish? To regulate, yes. Each feed regulates, and I don't know how you say it other than checks.
Revision.
Okay, there's revision of the other fields. Okay, so first of all, everyone does this indirectly by what they support and what they don't support. How we spend our money, how we spend our time, regulates all other kinds of work. Does that make sense to everybody? What products I buy, what services I use, who I support, who I don't support. So everybody regulates and revises everyone else in this way. The field of ideas particularly advises government, and the people in the field of ideas also creates the standards for all of the other occupations and teaches all the other occupations. So by people in the field of ideas being the teachers in all other careers, they regulate all other careers. The government regulates all careers by having ways of being certified, by having laws as to how you can behave in those careers, by what they say and by their example. The people in the field of resources regulate all other careers by what they spend their money on, right? Which of the arts they support. They use their wealth to set the quality and ethical standards for the society, what public works they support. Now that's very important, just like we see the modern media is mostly funded by big business. And so therefore the ideas that people are exposed to are coming not just from the people in the field of ideas, but they're being expressed through the field of artistry and funded by people in the field of resources and regulated by people in the field of government. Do you all follow that?
Yes. For me, it's too fast.
Okay. So people are influenced by what's in the media, yes? Yeah. Everybody follow that?
Yeah.
By the ideas in the media. Where does that come from? Does that come just from people in the field of ideas? No. People in the field of ideas need people in the field of artistry to translate those ideas into artistic expression. If people in the field of artistry refuse to translate things from the field of ideas, they don't get to people in general. But people in the field of artistry need people in the field of resources to financially back their artistic expression. Otherwise, it can't get out to people in general. People in the field of government need to allow the free expression of artistic ideas. So in this way, the people in the fields are regulating each other. No one field has full power over the others. Right? People in the field of artistry, also being in the greatest number, can regulate the other fields just by gathering together and deciding what they're going to support or what they're going to protest. And again, as people in the fields of artistry are the ones who translate ideas from the other three fields. So if you're in the field of ideas, you want to communicate some ideas, you probably need someone in the field of artistry to help you. If you're in the field of government, you probably need someone in the field of artistry to help bring your ideas out to the public. If you're in the field of resources, you probably need someone in the field of artistry to bring your ideas out to the public. Everybody follow this? And people in the field of artistry may pick up on something from the other fields and translate that into songs, into dramas, right? Into dance, into paintings. So the people in the field of artistry have tremendous control over what ideas from the other three fields come out into the public. Okay, he's translating. Okay, the last principle for systemic is that all prosperity should be sustainable. All prosperity should be sustainable. Modern economists have divorced economics from natural resources. Imagine that. All wealth is based on natural resources. All real wealth comes from the land, the air. Do you know the air is being turned into fertilizer? Did you know that? Did you know artificial fertilizer is made out of air? All of our natural resources come from the land, the air, the water, or the animals, the plants. Yes?
Yes.
All of our wealth. Those are finite resources that need to be sustained. Modern economics talks about growth and 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 has theoretically distanced itself from any concept of natural resources. That is madness. And something we Krishna conscious devotees have to offer the world is that sustainability is the economic model, not unlimited growth. The only place you can have unlimited growth is in the realm of the spiritual. If you want unlimited growth, you have to have spirituality. Then you can have unlimited growth of love, you can have unlimited growth of quality, you can have unlimited growth of caring, of understanding. But you can't have unlimited growth of natural resources. With that economic idea, modern society engages in force. My dear friends, if the only thing you remember from the seminar is this, the antithesis of spirituality is force. The antithesis of spirituality is force. If you are forcing yourself, others are nature, you are not in spiritual life. You are in demoniac life. We are forcing... Yes?
Can you paraphrase this? I don't get the
words. That's very good.
It's opposite of spirituality. Like Prabhupada says, you know, rape or love. We are forcing. Basically, we are raping the earth and the plants and the animals and people. We're forcing the land to produce more than it can naturally produce with artificial chemicals and fertilizers and pesticides. I read a whole book about how artificial fertilizers were developed from air. They're also used for explosives. And how it's upset the whole natural balance of the planet. Unbelievable. Forcing the soil. Forcing the plants. Breeding plants to force them to produce beyond their capacity. Forcing with monocropping, which then upsets the whole balance of the diseases and the system and the insects, acres and acres of only one crop. Forcing the animals, raising the animals in darkness, pumping them full of antibiotics and hormones so they get fat in one third the time. Forcing the people, work long hours. Have your work on your phone that you carry with you all the time so you can never be free of work. Go to school and go to work. Go to school so you can get a job until you're 25 or 30, so you can't even marry and have a family until you're 35 years old. Don't have any time to spend with your children. Forcing. And this has destroyed the psychological health of human beings. It's destroyed the physiological health of human beings. It's destroyed the health of the planet. So the fourth principle of the natural art of work is a system that has sustainable prosperity. The growth is in spirituality. The growth is in character. The growth is in values. And if we do this, we will actually have a richer life. Artificially forcing growth in an unnatural way has not left us holistically with a richer life. We may appear to be richer in some ways, but we are poorer in others. And the cost that we have paid is humongous. It doesn't mean that everybody has to, you know, live at New Vrajdam getting water out of a well. But it does mean that whatever we do should be sustainable. So what we talked about today was we talked about the eight principles of Varna Dharma for the individual, which were, again, to work according to our nature, to do honest work, which is receiving the real value of our work, providing for actual needs, not harming, doing work of value, which means being the intentional agent of spirituality for others, giving in charity all the variety of richness that we enjoy, having a regular time of connection with our source, with the Lord, cherishing the sources of our wealth, which is our body and mind, others, the environment, and the six ways in which we are rich, cherishing our field of work, keeping our field of work pure and sustainable, giving up ego and lethargy through dedicating every moment to Krishna, enjoying our prosperity through Krishna, being aware that we are a soul, letting go of ownership, not imitating others' work, and not being feverish. He talked about the four principles of work in a systemic way, competition within a field, cooperation between the field, each field regulating and balancing the other, and overall having sustainable prosperity. This afternoon, Krishna willing, at some time, we don't know yet what time, you will be surprised. We are in Spain, I assume, yes. Those of you who come from Switzerland will be very disturbed. Is anybody here from Switzerland?
No, not Swiss.
Oh, good. German? Are there Germans? Are there some? Two Germans. So our apologies to the Germans. But we're all in Spain, so what can be done? So we are going to have a seminar sometime in the afternoon. And we will know when it happens. So enjoy it when it happens. And in that seminar in the afternoon, we are going to be discussing what everybody's most interested in. Who am I? What is my nature? How do I find out what my nature is? And how do I connect that nature, the first principle of Varna Dharma for individuals, how do I connect my nature to how I earned a livelihood? Now, because I'm giving this presentation on a book that is in progress, we are right now going through our second draft of the book. So any of you who have any feedback after the class as to what you felt, did I need more information on something, less information on something, anything that you thought was good or anything you thought was bad or any feedback, I am extremely eager to hear. And Rukmini, if you are watching, Hare Krishna to you. So we have time for 10 minutes of question. Thank you for being here until 10 in the morning. And that's also very Spanish, right? Late meals. Yeah. So, yes?
You mentioned that people in the field of art history have a lot of influence in what ideas come out.
Yes.
Did you see that as something positive? Because my understanding is that that's like in Kali Yuga. This is what's happening now.
No, I see it as very positive that each field regulates the other field. So each field has power. I mean, it's possible for people in the field of ideas, government, and resources to circumvent the people in the field of artistry and bring their ideas directly to the people. And indeed, they do that. But the people in the field of artistry are very effective at bringing ideas to the general public. Often much more effective. And so in that way, they regulate the other fields. You know, our modern idea of democracy is not only that we vote for our leaders, but also that we have branches of government that regulate each other. Yes? We have the judicial branch, the executive branch, and the legislative branch. And no one branch is all powerful. And that was true even in a Vedic monarchy. You had the scriptures, right? You had the judges. It wasn't all one person. Because, frankly, we're all subject to imperfect senses, cheating, illusion, and mistakes. And so the fact that the fields can regulate each other is very important. And people in the field of artistry are not without power to regulate the other fields. Yes?
He has a dilemma, and he wants you to clear it up.
I will try.
Una vez estaba en Guatemala y íbamos a la playa, dos devotos y un amigo de Krishna.
We were in Guatemala and we were going to the beach, two devotees and two friends of Krishna.
El que conducía el coche era amigo de Krishna.
The driver was a friend of Krishna.
Pues paramos en un sitio que había unos bomberos pidiendo caridad.
And we stopped in a place where there were some firemen begging charity.
Y el amigo de Krishna le quería dar dinero.
And the friend of Krishna was willing to give him some money.
Y el otro devoto le decía, no, porque vas a pagar karma y tienes que venir a dárselo.
And the other devotee was saying, no, you should not give, because if you give, then you will create karma and then you will have to come back to give it to him back.
Y el amigo de Krishna me dijo a mí, que cuando éramos niños los bomberos salvaron a mi hermano.
And this friend of Krishna told me, well, when I was a child, the firemen saved my brother.
Pues yo le dije, dale, dale el dinero.
So I told him, you should give him the money.
¿Quién actuó bien?
Who was right?
Who was right? Well, Dharma is very complicated.
Dharma is muy complicado.
Yajna dana tapa karma na twajam karma meva tat yajna dana tapaschaiva pavanani manishinam. Acts of sacrifice, charity, and penance are not to be given up. They must be performed. Indeed, sacrifice, charity, and penance purify even the great souls. Now, sacrifice here, yajna, means religious performances. It doesn't mean giving something up, because that would be redundant. So yajna means... sacrifice doesn't mean giving something up. Like the English word sacrifice, you know, is different. Here, sacrifice, yajna, means religious or spiritual ceremonies. In a pejorative say, we could say ritualistic performances. It means doing some sort of religious thing. So we're supposed to do religious ceremonies, give charity, and take up some sort of austerity. And everyone is supposed to do that. So everyone is supposed to give charity. Now, Prabhupada does say that even good karma is entangling, and normally, if you give charity, you have to come back again so you can get the wealth that you earned by giving charity. But we devotees are not giving charity to get good karma. We are giving charity because Krishna says... Yes? This is the Bhagavad Gita. Is this the Bhagavad Gita? Was that spoken by Krishna? I think so, yeah? I think so. That was Krishna talking. Let's just check. Who was talking here? So, yeah. It's in the 18th chapter. Yeah, it's Krishna talking. Now, Krishna does say that charity can be in the modes of nature. So, although Krishna says everyone should give charity, everyone, even if you're a great soul, so even if you think, I am a great soul, you should still give charity. I'm a devotee. Nope, even you, give charity. Krishna says, if you want to argue with Krishna, he's right there after class, you can go and argue with him about this. But he says there's also charity in the modes. So we don't advise that people give charity in the mode of ignorance or passion. Charity in the mode of goodness is okay, but we advise you give charity in bhakti. So that's a whole other... I mean, I see in ISKCON we sometimes encourage charity in the mode of passion, even within ISKCON. That's charity given at the advice of a superior that you don't really want to do. And you do it under obligation. Well, my superior told me to do this. Charity also is not just money. Charity is of any of the six kinds of wealth. If you're sacrificing your energy, you're sacrificing virya. If you're sacrificing your knowledge, you're sacrificing jnana. There's sacrifice. Charity doesn't just mean giving money. Wealth is not just money. Whenever we give in charity something that we don't really want to give and we feel like we're obligated, that's in the mode of passion. Giving disrespectfully is in the mode of ignorance. Giving to the wrong people is in the mode of ignorance. Giving just so I'll feel, I'm a wonderful giving person, that's the mode of goodness. Giving so somebody else will say, you're a wonderful giving person, is in the mode of passion. So we should give charity to worthy persons, with respect, at the proper time, at the proper place, voluntarily from our heart, to make Krishna smile. But we should give charity. Now, exactly to whom you should give charity when is something beyond a general discussion. If a fireman saved your brother, then, my goodness, out of gratitude, you should give something to the fireman. That's just civilization. One of the 14 items of knowledge is gratitude. And according to Shastra, the worst person is the ungrateful person. You can't be worse than ungrateful. Just like it's a sacrifice without remuneration to the priest is in the mode of ignorance. If someone does something for you and you don't compensate them and you don't give them something, it's actually abominable. Even a lot of animals are grateful. Yeah? Not all, but... I mean, we once at the Detroit Temple, I don't know if you know what an opossum is.
What?
Do you know what an opossum is? It's a kind of animal. Anyway, they have lots of babies. They have more babies than they can take care of. And this mother opossum dropped one of her babies. And the Gurukul children told me, "Oh, Mother Emily, we have to take care of him." So anyway, so we took the little baby to the Gurukul and we took care of him. But he was very ungrateful. We called him Judda because he was so stupid. He was just so stupid. And he was never grateful. We raised him, took care of him, and then put him out in the woods. So some animals are not grateful. But many animals are grateful. Dogs are very grateful. Cats, dolphins are very grateful. Elephants, horses. I mean, many animals are grateful. So as humans, many birds are very grateful. So, of course we should be grateful. I don't think that's even charity. That's just gratitude. But exactly, if you're going to ask, should we give charity to this specific person, that's way beyond my capacity to answer that question. But as a general principle, everyone should give charity. And as a general principle, we should give charity to please Krishna. Giving money to a religious yajna is yajna, not charity, by the way. If you fund a yajna, that's yajna. So Krishna says yajna, dana, and tapa. So those are three things. So sometimes we think yajna and dana are the same. They're not. They're two different things. And everybody should give in charity. But exactly how and in which way, that's beyond the scope that I can answer. Yes?
Just another thing. I was reading in the life of Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur,
yes,
that he was advising his disciples to give charity to any person on the street. He was advising and he was saying that someone who doesn't give charity
is hard-hearted. Yes, the Bhaktisiddhanta said that. Of course, one should be discriminating. One should be discriminating. Just like my son-in-law, my daughter, and I are very involved in Radhakund, Chamakund, and Govardhan. We clean the holy places, we restore the holy places, and we are giving a lot of charity to widows there. So we became very aware that when you see a lot of these beggars in that area, it's basically being run like prostitutes and pimps. So when you give the money to those people, they're actually turning over that money to someone who's keeping most of that money and keeping them in poverty and exploiting them. They're often, a lot of those people are being treated like a prostitute would be treated like a pimp. So one should also be discriminating. And I think, it's worth our while to find out information about various charities, because otherwise, it's still the impulse to give and to help should not be stopped, but we should try to give in a way that actually benefits people and find, have some discrimination as to which charities and which situations are really going to be delivering to the people or the system in need, rather than necessarily just what presents itself in front of you. Because sometimes we can be contributing to an exploitive system. Sometimes our so-called charity can actually be perpetuating harm. Do you understand? If we're not careful. So, but the principle that Bhaktisiddhanta taught, that we shouldn't be hard-hearted. I'm a devotee, and therefore I don't care about people. I mean, this is... how abominable is that? And imagine... Just imagine the people who have this mentality. So we're going to go to the world and we're going to say, all right, we want to make the whole world Krishna conscious. And then everybody will stop helping everybody else. Oh my God, who would want us to be the advisors for the world if that was our view? Does that sound attractive to anybody?
I lost it.
If we have a mentality that if you become a devotee, you stop helping others in need, And we're saying the whole world should become devotees of Krishna. Why don't we think for a minute? Would we want everyone in the world to stop helping everybody else? Would we want to live in a world where people didn't help each other? Why would that be attractive? So, you know, people who say this, you just simply look at them and say, can you scale that up, please?
Scale
it. Make it bigger. Make it bigger. Everyone in Madrid acts like you say we should act. Do you want to live in that society? You follow? Everyone in Spain, nobody helps the poor anymore. Do you want to live in that society? Would anybody want to live in a society where nobody helped the poor? Anybody volunteer to live in that society? Obviously, then it's wrong. Does that make sense? It's obviously wrong. Now, how the poor should be helped, by whom, in what way, that is another discussion. That is a more complicated discussion. What's the role of government? What's the role of the brahmanas? You know, that the details of that is another discussion. But the concept that we shouldn't be charitable is absurd. Yes?
If I understand correctly, the field of artistry is not actually a substitute for sugars.
Indeed it is.
Can you repeat the question?
He's asking me if I'm using the term the field of artistry to indicate shudras, and the answer is yes.
But not all the shudras are like artists.
Every shudra is contributing to beauty and function in society. Tell me one shudra occupation that isn't contributing to beauty and function in society. Suppose you're picking up the garbage. Are you contributing to the beauty of society? There you go. You're in the field of artistry.
Now you mentioned this. I was doing Sankirtan in Madrid all the time in the same place. And I saw so many people cleaning the streets. And one day, there was this lady, you know, she was cleaning in such an artistic way, you know, really taking into it, you know, and she was looking everything to don't let anyone... She was like a dancer.
It was her craft.
Yeah, yeah.
Yes. It was her craft. Street cleaning is also a craft.
Yeah.
We have killed the soul of all the fields. We've killed the soul of the field of ideas. People in the field of ideas are the pet monkeys of government and resources. People in the field of government are the pet monkeys of resources. People in the field of resources are damaging everything. They're not properly regulated by government, and people in the field of artistry are forced to work mechanically and in factories. We've stripped out the soul of work from the world. It's a terrible, terrible thing. And we Krishna conscious people have something to offer the world. We don't just have the holy name and prasadam and deity worship and the philosophy of Krishna's playing in the forest of Vrindavan with the cowherd boys. That's not the only thing we have to offer the world. We have a social economic philosophy. That Srila Prabhupada thought was important. Yes? Am I correct or not?
Yes.
Did he talk about this a lot?
Yes.
Prabhupada did not just talk about chant the holy name and go back to Godhead and herd cows with Krishna and dance in Rasleela. He didn't just talk about that. He didn't say forget the world. Make your own little ghetto. Shut everybody else out. No, he's transformed the world. And transformed the world how? We have a social system. And I believe that we have been going about this social system in the wrong way. First of all, we just look at the details and we say to everybody, you have to keep cows and be faithful to your husband. That's just a detail.
We need first the days, no?
I don't believe that.
What?
He said, we first need a base. I don't believe it. I don't believe it anymore.
I mean, base, I don't mean...
Like a model.
I mean, not family, with base.
Each person, I believe, I'm convinced, that if everybody here took as many of these eight principles and instituted it in their lives, the eight individual principles, and speak about the four systemic principles, and try to have their work contribute to the four systemic principles, can only be done ultimately by government. But if some of the people following the eight individual principles, some of those people are going to be in the field of government. Government can then start putting out the four systemic principles. But people in the field of ideas can talk about the four systemic principles. We can try to do that as far as possible. It will make a difference. We individuals can make a difference. One of the famous anthropologists, Margaret Mead, said, don't believe that a small group of committed people cannot change the world, because that's the only way the world has ever changed. I do believe we can do this. We have to know what we're doing. If we think the only way to work in Krishna consciousness is in an ISKCON community, being a pujari, you know, or running the treasury, and that's it, and as soon as I go in the world, and as soon as I get a degree, and as soon as I have a career, well, that's just Maya Prabhu, oh, too bad. We'll never spread Krishna consciousness all over the world. We'll always just be a little religious sect. And our members won't be able to integrate their spirituality into their life, and we won't change the world. So instead of looking at the details, why don't we look at the principles? Because some detail of Varna Dharma and Ashram Dharma is not going to be applicable in 2018. We have so many details in the Shastra, it's not going to work. We're not going to have brahmacharis wearing deer skin or battles at weddings between kshatriyas. I mean, that's not going to go on. Could you imagine? We're going to take over the world, and you know, you're going to have people actually fighting over you at your wedding. And you go to get a bride, you might lose your hand. You know, you're not going to do that. But the principles we could do, the principles are applicable. And I believe that most of the principles we went over today are such that most intelligent people would say, I want that. I believe if we took what I just presented to the public, totally non-Krishna conscious people, not religious people, said these are the principles that most people would say, yeah, that would be really nice. Yes?
So we as devotees have something to share to the world.
Yes, I think so.
What?
She said we have something to share with the world, yes.
But at the same time, one big offense is maybe sharing this to people that doesn't have faith or won't understand.
This is not sharing the glories of the holy name. We don't have to worry. I am convinced that pretty much everybody in the world, unless they're a mafioso or something, you know, unless they're a really criminal person, will agree with these at least conceptually. Even the people who are acting in opposition to these will generally agree with at least the idea.
In opposition of what? You know, people who are acting in opposition of?
Opposition.
In opposition. Opposition. Not in a position.
No,
in
opposition. To whom?
To these principles. So even the people today who are doing dishonest work, who are subtracting value, who are exploiting their field, even those people, if you present this as the ideal, most of them would agree that this would be the ideal. Yes? Would you say that? I mean, how many people with these principles would say, no, no, that's a bad idea. We should just force and exploit until we run out of resources and condemn the planet? Even if they're the main ones doing that, at least in theory, they're going to agree. Yes? Am I correct? We're not talking about Radha and Krishna and Ras Lila. That's another. I mean, we do have that principle. We do have that principle of enjoying prosperity through the internal energy of the Lord. But we can explain that very easily. Everybody already says Mother Nature. Everybody already says God the Father and Mother Nature. Yes? That's not a foreign concept. Even atheists talk about Mother Nature. So that concept can be presented even like that. And we're presenting the Supreme in four ways. The universal form, because Prabhupada speaks about Varnashram in relation to the universal form. So universal form, Brahman, Paramatma, and Bhagavan. So everybody can relate to we are part of the universe. Even if you don't want to talk about a personal God. We're part of the universe, we're part of the planet. Someone's going to argue with that? So on that level, it can be given to everybody. And we need to have breakfast now,
yes.
Even though we're in Spain.
Yes.
Srila Prabhupada ki jai.